To say that the writer and artist Barry Dickens has been to hell and back would be an understatement. Early last year, Barry descended into deep depression, which saw him hospitalised and treated with electroconvulsive shock therapy. These days, Barry is again writing and painting and enjoying life with his young son. He's back. And he's written an account of his experience of depression and treatment called Unparalleled Sorrow. When we spoke last October, he'd only been out of hospital for a month, and he told me about the sort of person he was before the depression hit.
I would say unstoppably exuberant.
Right.
Always playing tennis, playing football, you know, terribly athletic and full of unstoppable life.
So engaged.
Eager with everything, you know, like Albert Einstein, who was once asked, what are your interests? And he said, everything.
So when did you realise that you weren't travelling so well?
It was on an author's tour to Wangaratta, to Bright, to Myrtleford. I was the artist in residence for a whole series of country libraries reading from my work. I've had about 35 books published, books of interview, books of prose, books of poems. And after about the fourth or fifth reading from my work in those public country libraries, I suddenly couldn't speak. I really had no idea who I was or where I was. I just went completely blank.
That's very profound, isn't it?
Well, it's so unsettling because I love to speak. I adore to, like all writers, I'm an egomaniac and love to perform and to make people smile and to amuse them or distract them or even enrage them is something I love to do. And so I've been a writer for a long, long time and an entertainer for a long, long time on the ABC, on Channel 9, Channel 7. So I'm a veteran of reading my prose aloud to an audience, and to not be able to do it, not through shyness or anything else, but depression, clinical depression in a profound way.
What was happening at your life at the time?
I was losing the marriage and was aware of that in my bones or in my DNA. I knew that I wasn't loved, you know, that my wife had stopped loving me, and that contributed to the blankness. It wasn't everything. There were lots of other forces. But the general result was that of depression, something out of Sylvia Plath or something out of a poem, except that it wasn't artistic. It was sort of social. I couldn't drive. I couldn't dress. I could only lie in bed, not out of indolence. It wasn't laziness, because as I said, I've always had tons of energy. It was just a death-like state where you feel that everything is futile. There's just generally no point to being animate.
So how long did this go on from when you kind of had the crisis during the reading to actually, getting a diagnosis?
Yeah, well, about 4 weeks where I foolishly stayed with my wife. I should have moved out. We weren't getting on, and that was my fault, and it wasn't. It was sort of ambiguous. We're both contributing to the breakup of the marriage. We got a little boy living with us and whom we both adore. I really, as I say, I should have moved out and found somewhere else to live, because if you don't adore each other, you really shouldn't be living together, I don't think, in retrospect. But about 4 weeks, and then my wife took me to St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne, which is in Carlton, where I've often visited writers, ironically enough, who end up there. It's like the Elysium, you know, the meeting place for dead heroes. They all go to St Vincent's. And hundreds of authors have ended up at St Vincent's in Melbourne through depression or marriage breakup. So I'm one in a chain of those authors or those painters who can't make a living, or they can but not that well. And I was diagnosed with not schizophrenia, which I feared I had, because I was certainly hearing lots of voices that didn't seem mine, but that's just a hyperactive imagination. And I was diagnosed with clinical depression and anxiety, and then a referral to a clinic about 3 miles from there in Albert Park.
I mean, that would be quite a moment to get that diagnosis, but in a way, was it a kind of relief?
I don't know. I was still blank. I mean, the diagnosis, as you suggest, Richard, it helped, for then I knew what was wrong, you know, that there was no doubt that I had something common. It wasn't something rare. Clinical depression is so common. It's almost a bore. So many children have it. I mean, at the clinic that I went to, there were children who had depression. There were, in the ward that I was in, there was a child who had depression who was about 14. He was also bipolar and had other things wrong. But we had a rapport. I felt I had bipolar, all the other things, you know, like a trendy, you know, if you're going to have bipolar, I'll top you and I'll have bipolar too. I went into shock treatment, not that I wanted to. I had no authority. I didn't speak for 3 months.
Hang on. You're not saying you had the electroconvulsive therapy against your will, are you, or without consent?
No, I didn't want it. I didn't want it, and I now regret having had it. It was a request of my psychiatrist, and not a request, but he put it in train, and I had no say. I mean, I wasn't meek. I just lost all sense of identity, and that if someone rosters you on for a convulsion, then off you go. You don't think this is for me or this isn't for me. You just become compliant, and you become institutionalized almost automatically, and you just go along with things. And I truly regret that now. If I could go back in time, I would have signed myself out of that place.
What's it like to have...
What, having it?
Yes.
Well, where I was, it was scheduled for 6:30 each morning. It lasts about an hour. And I said to my psychiatrist once, can't you please schedule the treatments for later in the day when they come and collect me, the four male nurses, in their white gowns. I feel like I'm in a Sylvia Plath poem. You know, it just heightens the sense of unreality that they come that early. And also, when you interview me, I'm so heavily medicated at your insistence that I really can't respond to your questions. And I am an interviewer myself. I've worked as an interviewer for radio and for television and for the press and for my books of interview. I'd really appreciate it if they could be later in the day. And do you know what he said to that?
No.
That's about all the time we have for you today, Mr. Dickens.
Oh, right. Can I ask you, Barry, are you a morning person? Or because writers are often evening people.
Well, I was very morning this morning. I'm writing a book on the depression for a publisher. I've got it at 45,000 words. And it came to me last night, talking to the editor, that at the end of the book, or the last third, will be unending brightness, that I'll go out of melancholia or gloom, or call it what you will, joylessness, into playing tennis with my little son, table tennis with my little son, joyfully sharing my son with my wife, since we're not fighting, and that he sees that. He sees that the love is gone between us, but not the friendship. I feel like some sort of creature that's been released off some sort of chain, and I'm galloping through some incredibly bright grass, like jade green grass or something, that all the senses have returned. With the end of the ECT and the end of the medication, I feel vindicated, and I've never felt happier.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Barry Dickens, the writer and artist, and as you have been hearing, he's been through a bit of a rough time, and he had electroconvulsive therapy, but has now recovered. He doesn't feel that it's because of that therapy. Barry, when did you start to see the end of the tunnel, to realise that you were going to get better?
I think it was the winning of a prize. I won a prize in the 13th week of my confinement, and 9 doses of electroshock therapy or electroconvulsive, all the euphemisms they use for it. But I was done 9 times, and felt innumerate, really, because it's just happening all the time. But I won a prize, which in Melbourne is really something, and in Melbourne, where I was born and where I work mostly, I won a prize, and a psych nurse gave me an envelope one morning, which when I opened it contained a letter from the Victorian State Library, and that they run a literary competition, and it can be for drama, for poetry, for prose, whatever you like, and I won it. It was for a manuscript for a one-man play based on the life of Brett Whiteley. The Melbourne Theatre Company entered that script since they commissioned it, and it won. And when I got that letter, it was like it was time to check out.
Could you feel your level of engagement and your senses returning?
Everything. It all came back as swiftly as it vanished, and it was that I'm back in the theatre, I'm back speaking, I'm back rewriting, I'm in love with the actor who's playing Brett Whiteley. I'm in love with the director. You know, I'm signing contracts again. I'm back in the world of the living, which is the theatre, to fill the theatre with amused patrons and laughing patrons, crying patrons.
Mm.
I'm a man of the theatre. And the nurse said, if you keep reading that letter, you'll wear it out. And that was her first joke in 13 months.
13 weeks.
13 weeks. It felt like 13 months.
And has everyday life changed?
It's brightened. It's as if I've got the sandy blight out of my eyes. You know, you've probably walked through a mistral or, you know, somewhere sandy and dusty and you get all that muck out of your eyes and I can see again. And I see the folly of it all. I see that there was no point having the arguments. There was no point being mean to my wife or having minor victories or receiving minor defeats. The only way through is to be respectful and realise that the life is sacred. I am someone who adores to be alive.
And I understand you've plotted what you call your depression lineage. What have you found out?
Well, I found out a lot of it goes back to my mother. I mean, my mother, Edna, is 85 on the 2nd of December. She lives in suburban Reservoir with my father, Len, who is 90. You know, I adore them. And my elder brother, John, is 62. He's their carer. And my dad is still pretty fit. He still does the garden and his back is nice and straight. But my mother's got osteo and other... She's got mental illness, much, much worse than I became, or maybe not. And maybe I was as profoundly ill as she is. And she couldn't speak as I couldn't. There is a connection between her collapse and my collapse, I think.
Have you changed what they call the lifestyle issues, so diet and drinking habits, exercise, that kind of thing? Exercise is supposed to be very helpful for depression.
Well, I'm playing tennis every single night now. And my little boy, Louis, his name is... I pick him up after school. He's in year seven. He's fantastic at tennis. And I grew up loving tennis too. And we can't wait to get to the courts. You know, they're over at Fitzroy, which is central Melbourne, and old crushed brick courts. We bag the courts, we water the courts, we sweep the lines. You know, we play for a couple of hours. I'm not fit, but I give him a pretty good game, and we're great friends. And the other thing, too, to say is that when I was young, what got me interested and intrigued in respect of literature was that my father, Len, used to read to my brother John and myself out in our bungalow in the backyard when we were children. And I was then 7 and John was 11 and he slept in the above bunk, I slept in the below one. And in the windy bungalow, our father would come, you know, after he'd scrubbed up all the printing ink off his wrists, and after dinner he'd read to us. And he was a beautiful reader aloud of fiction and read to us from The Coral Island and Treasure Island and The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes. He knew that off by heart. And always there were these readings. And I used to go to sleep dreaming of those images that Len gave us. And now I'm 59 and I'm reading to my 13-year-old son in a double-decker bunk. I mean, that's incredible when you think about it, that here am I with long white beard and baggy eyes. I mean, I look like a stood-on apricot. And there's my little boy listening until he goes to sleep because he said, "What are you going to read to me tonight, Dad?" And he calls me Daddles. You know, "When are you going to read, Daddles?" Or when we're playing tennis, he calls me Old Cheese, and I call him Young Cheese. And we've got all these love words for each other and a fantastic friendship, as there was between Len and I when I was Louis's age and being read to until I was about 13 or 14.
What goes around comes around.
Yeah, that's right. And the peace that I obtain from that is untellable or unshareable. It's just heaven.
Can I ask you, Barry, about the future? What's in store now?
What I want to do is what I've always wanted to do, which is to live every second and really thank Christ I'm alive, although I'm not a practicing Christian. I believe in the sanctity of life and, you know, I've got all these books and plays I want to do. I'm determined to be a better listener because I am a fairly hepped-up sort of a man. And, you know, when I teach as a resident in schools, I work with the preppies best. Preppies are best for me when I go into a residency because they know that I truly listen to them and it's not a put-on. That's something that I couldn't give away and I want to go back into working with preppies in schools with their poems and their drawings and all that sort of thing.
Well, Barry, It's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so.
We recorded that interview with Barry Dickens at the end of October last year as he was finishing his book, and his account of finding his way back from depression is called Unparalleled Sorrow. It's published by Hardy Grant Books and comes out early next week.